Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Jenny Wren. I've been a festival booker for over 15 years, mom of two, four if you count the dogs. I've buried my sister and my parents, partied like it was 1999 for over 20 years, modelled for 5 minutes, worn far too many accessories and not enough self-care. I've had breast cancer and epiphanies. Safe to say, she's been around. You're listening to Hindsight Conversations, where my guests are invited to bring to the table what it is they want to discuss, feel ready to share from where they are in their lives. We meet it together with no agenda. No topic is off limits, from the frivolous to the profound, the gnarly to the joyful, painful to the practical. Red flag moments you can only see when looking back, but looking back to move forward. Join me weekly where we explore the 2020 vision of hindsight. Everyone has it. Ryan Vell is an electronic artist. He blends the worlds of electronica, folk and classical, always experimenting, combining classical instruments with unique methods of recording and composition. Ryan, I'm honored to say, is our spotlight artist for the next 3 months. It's his music you can hear as the intro to this podcast. His most recent album, Borders, was a collaborative project with Elma Orchestra, which won the 2019 Album of the Year category at the Northern Irish Music Prize. A symphony of electronic and analogue components combine and enhance the live Borders show beyond its natural boundary. Cinematic drone footage of the Irish border and countryside is accompanied by string players, classical composition and vocal appearances from Moya Brennan and Stephen James Smith for a full-on assault of the senses, which has taken them from deepest Mexico to the Berlin Wall. Ryan has had extensive radio play and performed live sessions with the likes of BBC Introducing, Lauren Laverne, Annie Mac, Tom Ravenscroft, Zane Lowe, just to name a few. He's also toured extensively and he's truly a prolific artist. In this episode, Ryan and I settle into a conversation, opening with the death of his beloved manager and friend of mine, the late great Lyndon Stevens, who passed just before the pandemic hit. We traverse from grief, helping younger musicians, where he started, and culminates with him telling us about his new exciting project with Tide Surf magazine and the origins of how this wonderful project came about. A really warm, honest conversation.
For me, the start of the pandemic was kind of probably the most testing time because obviously my manager, London, had just passed a few months prior to that. Me and the whole team, we were kind of just like in this kind of place where we didn't know how to operate, essentially, because I don't think anything can really like prepare you for something like that. Plus, we didn't really know what was coming because, London died of cancer. He was given all clear, like, 6 months prior to that, and he was like cycling around Ireland raising money for charity. So we were all in this kind of like real advanced like production. We were all writing loads of music and we had all these tours and stuff all planned, and we were all kind of working on overdrive. So when we kind of won the album award and we had all these like huge shows planned from like America, Canada, Dubai, and it just felt like, okay, this is like the last 8 years worth of like graft has come to this point and we're finally going to see the fruits of our labor. That all kind of fell apart quite quickly. And I think that was a testament to how tight me and London were as a team and how we worked so well together and kind of worked off of each other too. It wasn't just like London just worked for me. I worked for London as well. And it kind of just really made me think how important the team that you surround yourself with is. And over time, that team becomes almost like family as well. I suppose you spend that much time around them. So yeah, essentially I went into the pandemic kind of just with my head in between my legs going, what in under God is going on? This just feels like everything's been like taken away. And there was that kind of realization. It was like, okay, right. And all these huge things that happen, some people are going to make money and some people aren't. And at that point of realizing that's what it's essentially going to come down to, it's survival. Me and Owen, who was the other half of the Borders Project, decided to try not to be the ones that weren't going to make money. So we quickly realized, and this was a really sad realization that I think many artists took a long time to come to, was our art and our music became like a luxury and almost like a selfish act during the pandemic because it couldn't support our families. So for many of us, we were going into the studio and feeling guilty that we were in the studio, because before that, we would go into the studio and make our art, and then our art would create financial stability, where all of a sudden we were just going in and making our art and there was no way of creating any like money. So for a lot of us, our mindset around music was challenged quite a lot. And for me and Owen, it was very much the case, because we both have young families and mortgages, and you know, we were sustaining ourselves 100% with our music. So we started kind of like reaching on the other avenues. And the big one for us was, before Borders, I had toured like a laser show. So I had all this like huge production. I had moving beams, lasers, lights, strobes, everything. And Owen had really good camera kit from Borders. So we decided to stream one of the first streamable HD full production shows in the UK. Ticketed. And at the time, everybody was kind of just streaming for free, which I absolutely detested. I just thought, this feels like the only way that we can make money. And everyone's went under this kind of like attitude of, hey, we're going to entertain the world and do it for free, unaware that that is their job and that's how they're probably going to have to make money for the next year and a half. So we were in the total opposite end of the spectrum. We were like, no, we're going to ticket what we're going to do, and we're going to do it at a high production value because we're lucky enough to have everything. So we set up a black tent and put on, I think it was like 24 stage lights, streamed it full HD, put it up for tickets. We sold 150 tickets at, I think it was between £15 and £20 a ticket. So that was kind of like a household could watch. So we were kind of in the mindset that for every ticket that was sold, and yeah, done really well. Got us a lot of attention because no one was kind of doing it at that point. And it led on to like a new business venture for us, and that was camera work. And literally overnight, we just had this huge amount of like, can you film this? Can you do this? Can you make short films of this? And the fact that me and Owen were already composers, it took a lot of this kind of, you know, we need these ones to do the filming and we need these ones to do the music. We became like this one-stop shop where people could just come and get everything done. So yeah, it just kind of turned into this mad year of like an insane amount of work. We started employing our friends that were out of work and just had this network of let's turn this around. Let's try and make this something good. And that's where Owen had Amelia Film started up. So that was like the main hub for all the film work. I started then taking it further with Oisin O'Brien from DSNT, and we had Visual Spectrum was a collaborative kind of startup with like loads of people where we all just came together, animators, and started basically realizing that everything had to go online. And we had all the tools to do that creatively. Whether it was sound design, animation, and basically just, yeah, turned a bad situation kind of quite good. So yeah.
You're putting me to shame anyway. I was sitting in the garden at 4 o'clock with gin and tonics, enjoying the sun, you know, twiddling my hair, wondering, you know, oh, I didn't know a bird lived up there.
Well, I think, to be honest, I think that was the case for a lot of people and a lot of people that we brought on board. And I think a lot of people are really good at one thing and they specialize at it and they become masters at it. And for me, a lot of my friends, I would consider them masters of this particular thing, where I kind of feel like through being like a self-sustaining artist, I've had a real business mind from like quite early on. So for me, it was like 50% music and 50% business to make the music work. So I think all that training with London for like that 8 years prior kind of, you know, all of a sudden I came out and it was like, oh, you know how to like turn these things around, because we've had so many difficult things in the past. I kind of feel like that's where it was different.
I mean, as you were speaking, I mean, obviously, well, not obviously for anyone listening, I was very close to Lyndon and had the, you know, opportunity to work with him differently. I was a, you know, let's say a buyer of music, so to speak. And, you know, but we connected in a lot and we would just check in with each other. And I thought of him so much throughout the lockdown because Lyndon was just, there was just always the silver lining. There was always something to do. There was always an idea. There was always a door. Yeah. There was always a plan. Yeah. And anything I might have an, you know, thoughts on, or like you could ring Lyndon and with no ego, with your best interests at heart, would go, well, I don't know, Jenny, you know, and then kind of like, and the next thing the wheels are turning and you're talking about something else. And then, so it's, as you were speaking, I felt like I was nodding like a proud mother, because I just know Lyndon would be like, yes, you know, I was going to ask if, do you think the all the years working with him helped support that business mindset and that, okay, this, you know, let's not sit here lamenting like I did in the garden looking at birds. Let's get moving and look at what we have. So I really applaud you for that. And Lyndon, I must say, because I really think, you know, he'd be so incredibly proud. Yeah. But, you know, we touched on, or you touched on, Lyndon's passing at the beginning of it all. And it, you know, while we knew he had cancer, we were not prepared for him to go that quickly.
No.
I suppose I want to give a pause moment to, or a little bit, not even energy, but just, that was a huge loss.
Yeah.
A huge loss coming into this very strange reality of, We're going into what? Lockdown? Like these were all words that we would not have put together before. Yeah. You know, we were having conversations that just sounded like they were completely mad.
Yeah.
How was just that piece for you?
Yeah, I think that kind of like December to March period, I definitely struggled mentally, because London wasn't just like, it wasn't like a manager for me. We would have spoke daily, quite a lot daily. So like we were in contact all day, every day. Even like when people stopped working, we were still emailing and still figuring things out. So it was quite a, and even like, it was weird, because even when he was in his hospital bed, we were still doing the same thing. You know, we were still lining up gigs as if everything was sweet. And, you know, so when he actually passed, I don't think I was kind of prepared for it, because he had me so distracted. Mm. And he had me so like work focused that I just didn't have time to compute. And I could see what he's doing now, looking back. It was very smart. But he was obviously thinking, oh, he needs to keep writing, because he might have a roadblock, because of what will happen. So he was almost like he was preparing me to have something ready for it. But when it happened, I didn't really deal with it too well. Looking back, I wouldn't be one of these people who can like just go and talk to people about it. Mm-hmm. I'm not that way inclined. So my wife kind of said, you know, you need to probably like work this out in your own way. Mm-hmm. And why don't you return to the ocean? So previously, and like earlier, before London came on board, I kind of had a rough part of my life where I kind of left uni and everything was kind of basically just falling apart. And I bumped into a local kind of surfboard shaper called Rosie. And he basically just gave me a surfboard and started taking me to the ocean every day. And he was like, just come. He was like this kind of Rasta vibe, you know, reggae music going down, we just surf. And all of a sudden it just like cleared my mind and I was just like so focused again. So the wife kind of, you know, asked me to start thinking about doing that again. She was like, you know, I'll buy you a board. Why don't you just, we're so close to the beach, just start doing it again. You haven't had any time because you've been so busy with music. And I did. I just got a wetsuit, started going. It was the heart of winter. The water was so Baltic. It was like -6 degrees. There was howling -2 winds. But it was so therapeutic being on under cliffs, howling weather. It's snowing on you. And it was just like battling it out physically, just working out these things in your head. And the more I'd done it, the more creative I started becoming. I started returning to the studio. I was like, I really want to write something now. And, you know, it just kind of, yeah, just worked it out over a couple of months to the point where I could talk about it then. Wow. It was just like, okay, now I can speak about this. And there was a radio interview where they asked me about it. And I, up to that point, it was probably like just break down in tears. And it was like the first time I could actually like hold myself together to actually like physically speak about it. So yeah, there's a lot to be said about just being active and really, really testing times and, you know, not falling into that pit of like staying indoors and not speaking to someone, you know. It's all right not to speak to people, but maybe like find a way of just, you know, staying healthy during it all.
Yeah, I've read before, you know, not necessarily prolific, but, and I have found it myself, you know, grief, it's so weighty and so heavy. And as you've said very beautifully, you weren't, you know, you're not immediately a talker and you need time to process, and people do need time to process it. And, but it's so, I think, physically weighty. There's like this emotional drain that you need movement. You actually need physical movement to start like shaking it up through your cells, through your body to get any, you know, to be able to process it in your brain. And, you know, I have this beautiful image of, you know, kind of battling through the freezing water and that leading you back to the studio and being able to talk about it. So that's, it's a very beautiful thing, really. But we do need time to process and a way to process. And for me, I definitely agree because the feeling I would certainly get is like, oh, I'm just going to sit under a blanket and I'm going to just sit staring at something. But you actually need to physically move, don't you?
Yeah. Mm. It's just creating that kind of place where you can kind of forget about everything for a while and just kind of, yeah, there's something about working up a sweat and just getting adrenaline going just kind of seems to heal a lot. And it's kind of a beautiful thing when you think about it.
It is.
It's like, it's just connecting with nature at the kind of your lowest point and it's healing you. So it's a beautiful thing.
So not only had you lost Lyndon, but, you know, the, as you've rightly put, and I think this is something that people maybe didn't fully appreciate. And I was getting it. I really, the whole online streaming and, as you say, sitting down with the guitar. I mean, this is your art. This is your work. This is like, you know, this is your livelihood. This is how you're paying your mortgage and raising your kids. So I am so amused because I'm thinking the Lyndon, but like, why would you put that incredible show out for free? Of course you should ticket it, you know, it just, my mind was bending with that kind of thing. I almost had to step away. I couldn't quite deal with it, to be honest with you.
I think for a lot of us, we did switch offline when we seen that happening because it felt like we should have all got together as one whole music community and had like some kind of like discussion about it or something. But what happened was, it maybe showed the flaws of the music community and how, you know, how many different sectors there is within it. And like I was saying from the start, I said, you have to understand, like, no matter what happens, we're going to be the last to be looked at. So we have to create some kind of sustainability on what we do. So I was like saying this to the young acts that were around me and stuff, like the likes of Ro. So Ro was very clever because if she was streaming, she was always either being paid to be streaming or she was charging for the stream. So we were kind of trying to have these discussions with people, you know, we need to keep some kind of like monetary value on this. But it was just, the scene was just so big. It was like a lost cause. You know, you had the kind of wedding band scene, then you had the pub singer, and you had, and yeah, it just kind of got out of control to the point where I think myself and Owen streamed on the side of a cliff. So we once we had the lockdown restrictions lifted, we got a huge production show at the side of a cliff on the top of Mullinhead, shooting beams over the Atlantic Ocean and stuff. And for us, that was like signing off of streaming. We were like, okay, no one else has done this in Ireland. We've kind of gone above and beyond. That's us signing off. And it was just nice to have some kind of control over that. And we had a lot of people still ask us to stream. We're just like, no, we feel like that's as far as we can go with streaming, and we're happy to leave it at that. But yeah, it was a weird thing. Like another thing that we discovered in it all as well was the music industry has like a lot of people are on full-time wages and have like pension plans, and a lot of these people don't actually make music. So we're like, right, so that's the sector that essentially has become kind of not more supported by the government, but they tend to have been kind of like safer during it all. Mm-hmm. And then the musicians, kind of very few of them had a backup plan. So they weren't saving for a rainy day. They didn't have pension savings. They didn't have like books, essentially. So they weren't even like keeping proper books. So we were kind of helping a lot of people even try to apply for grants that they couldn't get because they weren't keeping their books right. And it was just like, it just felt like there was such this like huge divide that we were seeing, where there was one group that was really well set up and they were going to be supported, and this other group that was just like, they were so free and so creative that they hadn't got anything in place. And it was just like, oh no, how do we fix this? You know what I mean? And it's like, so yeah, it was just, there's so many things that were highlighted during it that need to be addressed going forward. It's just, yeah.
And do you feel you will bring some of those things forward? You know, you sound extremely passionate about it in terms of, you know, looking at these younger bands or more free bands or, you know, the creative thinkers. You had the legacy of Lyndon perhaps behind you and with you, with the 50% business and 50% creative. Is that something I hear that you were helping? Is that, do you find people coming to you now because of that? Is that something you're...
Yeah, like it felt like a full-time job for about 4 months, because all the arts grants and everything, I just had this like mad funnel of people coming at me. And to be honest, like I probably got through 90% of them. 90% of them ended up being successful. A few weren't. You can't save them all. But I done my best. But yeah, we were talking to MLAs as well. We were trying to get some of the stipulations moved for, you know, how long people had books and stuff. Because there was even people like my management, like Francesca and Ben, who were just coming off apprenticeships and they were only starting their books. Like there was essentially nothing financially supporting that, people like that. So like they'd done all this trading, they were going on to their work. And because they didn't have this like financial background of like 2 years, that they were deemed as just being unemployed for that kind of, you know, time. So yeah, there's a lot of conversations with MLAs and stuff, and a couple of spearheaded groups kind of were started up to try and address it. But yeah, people still slip through the cracks, unfortunately.
Yeah, and as you say, you can't save them all, particularly when you're trying to manage yourself and your own family and your household and taking on this new, well, I mean, I guess new is perhaps the wrong word. That you had, as you mentioned, all the equipment and the film work. But you hadn't dived into it maybe as much before?
It was something I always wanted to do. Okay. So like, I've always wanted to bring the live show to almost like a film experience. Mm-hmm. But with the understanding to do that, it's huge budgets and huge, just technically really difficult to do. So I'd always in my mind that eventually everything would work towards this grand show that I would eventually develop. I just didn't realize it would take a pandemic to kind of, you know, get me closer to that place, because I'm so buzzy, because I write for TV. I do a lot of sound work with big composers. Like I would co-produce for a lot of big dance acts, and my studio time is really busy. So when I'm not touring, I'm pretty flat out in the studio. So I just never seen the time for me to really start learning these techniques. I suppose it's coming up in 2 years now of the pandemic, really. It's and I've probably learned, like at the weekend there, I was directing Boiler Room AVA. So we had a full camera crew out. I was directing them, doing the live cut, looking after all that. A year and a half ago, I wouldn't have known anything about that. So it's it just shows you how much you can really learn and push your career within, you know, when you're being kind of, your back's up against the wall, I suppose.
I guess, but I tend to go to the emotion or the human side of it. And what I hear is a great resource within you. Yeah. To, you know, and I think that you probably, I'm not saying you haven't, but I think here and now I'd like to kind of just hold a space for that for a second and go, hang on a minute, you know, that's pretty incredible that, yeah, it is something you wanted to do, but yeah. This ability within you, where, you know, we often say it's the creative side that, you know, wanting to move forward, but there is a great strength there within yeah. you to move forward and take it and not just kind of dabble at it, to really take it on and do it really, really well. And I think that's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it's, don't think I've seen it coming, but you learn a lot about yourself in these situations. Yeah, about how much you can be pushed and how much you can push back. And I don't know, it's interesting. Like, and I think for a lot of us now that are kind of moving on with things, it's just trying to wait. Like, essentially, I was hoping to announce shows October and start getting back out touring. And a week ago, we had to pull everything again. So we've had to pull these shows now 6 times. And these are all shows that I've waited a lifetime to play, like the South Bank Centre and like London and all these real cool monumental shows. Mm. And every time I pull them, it's just like this, like, dagger piercing me. It's just like, I can't handle pulling shows any longer. Can we just stop booking shows? Because I would rather, there's something about the adrenaline of someone like yourself contacting London, do you want to play Body and Soul? Yeah, let's do it. Which day? And there's that excitement of, you know, and then you start thinking about the live show, but booking a show for 4 weeks later, but to be like, oh, now we need to move it 2 months forward. Oh, now we need to move it another 2 months forward. It just takes all the goodness out of it. Just takes all the excitement out of it. And it just becomes this, like, so what kind of affair now? Okay. And it sounds awful to say that, but it's moving so much that you just get in the mindset that, like, you don't think it's ever going to happen.
Wow.
And it's just, yeah, so I've kind of asked my management and booking agent now to just stop booking stuff until we know we can go out.
Yeah.
Because it's playing with our emotions too much. You know what I mean? It's like dangling that carrot.
There's only so much disappointment and heartbreak and loss, I think, a human being can manage. No amount of sea swimming is going to keep, you know.
And I'm sure it's similar for yourself. You know, you book the festival and you get that rush.
Yeah, there is a rush. Yeah, there is a rush. And I think there's something, I remember having this moment of clarity, which is quite off topic, but I'll hopefully be able to bring it back on. When my father had a terrible accident, he was a very elderly man and he was essentially knocked down crossing the road. It was awful. And what I noticed most about myself at the time is that you can nearly handle the outcome or the death, let's say, but the not knowing bit in between is absolutely fucking awful.
Yeah.
Then this incongruent, muddy space of not knowing, I personally don't sit well with it either. So like you, I'd be kind of like, either give me the chocolate or don't give me the chocolate. Give me the festival or don't, you know, this kind of like, maybe, and, you know, shall we plan for, and then that all to fall apart. I personally do not have great tools to manage that kind of thing. It's like, I want to know for sure. Or so I really empathize with artists, the stop, start, the no real plan from government, the you know, just this muddy space of what the hell. Yeah. So it's I'm not surprised that you've had to just say, listen, let's not book anything until there's clarity. Because it's an awful lot to manage emotionally, and you're still trying to be creative, and you're still trying to, you know, it's not like.
I think for most artists now, we've probably wrote the album, we've wrote the new album. Do you know what I mean? We just want that, like, you know, writ of how and when we can do it. Do you know what I mean? And it's like,
what is that like? Sorry, I've interrupted you, but I'm afraid I'll forget it. What is that like to write an album and not be able to put it out with the. You know, that must be very hard.
Yeah, that's the most frustrating part, because I'd be quite a prolific artist. So I like writing the album, developing a show, turn it hard, and then moving on to the next kind of thing. But like stopping that creative chain that I was kind of in was quite difficult. It was like, okay, so I've got an album here, and what do I do here? And they're just like, oh, do you want to work that track again or try this on this track? And after 20 revisions of each track, you're kind of going like, I need to, step two needs to happen here. Mm-hmm. It's like, so I think for everybody now, it's like, we shouldn't be writing more music. Mm. We should be on to that next part. And I was out kind of doing like some jobs washing recently. We were down in the Sauna Festival in Limerick. We were doing AVA and stuff, and we're like, you know, everyone's coming up and they're going, "Oh, you're not playing?" And I'm going, "No, I'm not. To be honest, I'm not really into these token festivals that are happening. I kind of feel like it's giving the government a wee bit of ammo to kind of not really come out with the goods. So I just didn't really want to be involved in this kind of like low capacity events that were essentially allowing them to sign off financial support. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was seeing from it. I was like, okay, so they're kind of saying that we're working. They've stopped the financial support, but it's like one festival every 5 months. Mm-hmm. That's the reality. And we're still not in venues. So yeah, it's definitely hard to navigate what they've laid out in front of us.
Yeah, that piece is definitely gritty. I'm not a prolific artist by any stretch of the imagination, but when I have an idea, and if I have to, you know, even this podcast, ironically, I've often said that, you know, actually putting it out was a process of me not killing yet another creative idea. I to kind of get, you know, unlike you get you put it out, but I sort of ruminate on things, and then if I sit with it too long, I literally kill it off. It's like, and then I hate it. Then I hate it. I go full circle with it, and I bury it. I have this little graveyard of all my creative ideas, and I would almost tend to them, going, "Oh, maybe that kind of was a good idea." But that holding, and I guess you would nearly have it on cellular level that you're like, you're ready to go. That there's a process with you. The album done, you should be out there. And are you? So you're in that holding space at the moment. Are you still sea swimming? Like, what are you doing to support yourself to not, you know, go down a sort of a dark hole with it all? Or
So basically, I started. So when the kind of two companies started generating kind of good income, I started to kind of not feel bad, but I kind of felt like I wanted to give something back. So I had this mad idea that surfing had like given so much back to me, and I felt like I was kind of indebted to it after, you know, kind of essentially healing thing for me. So I ended up going and starting this online video magazine called Tide Surf Magazine. And the idea was I was going to create this central hub for everything surf related in Ireland to come to and support and create, just basically really cool content at a highly filmed level and boost careers of Irish surfers. So for me, I was getting a lot out of it because the filming's quite difficult. You know, you're in the Atlantic Ocean with an underwater camera and big waves. You're filming drones and heavy winds, and these surfers are giving it their all, trying essentially not to hurt themselves on rocks. But it was really riveting, and, you know, I ended up getting all this beautiful film content that just makes Ireland look like this, like, vast landscape of beauty. So I started scoring it then, and I was like, I'm going to make this video magazine, have this huge score. Everything's shot beautifully, coloured beautifully, to the point where we're going to launch it in the cinema now at the end of the year.
Wow.
So, yeah. So this is just like one of these ideas that you're like talking about, where I just kind of went, do you know what? Surfing's an Olympic sport now. Ireland's got some of the greatest surfers in the world, and it's like a free-for-all. There's nothing for them here in Ireland. The association hasn't really run that well. There's nothing content-wise helping them online to make them sports personalities that we should all know. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We should know these people that are top to win the Olympics. And for me, it's like, it's a cool sport. It's like, you know,
oh, it is.
They all listen to good music. They can all dress. It looks good. It's a healthy thing, you know. And I was just like, this just needs to be addressed. So I just kind of, in my spare time, I've been doing that. And it's been really successful. We haven't even like released the first issue. We've got two juniors with three major sponsors. We've raised corporate sponsorship deals for them.
That's, yeah. I mean, what an arc of a story there. We couldn't have plotted that better.
But it's so fresh. You know, we haven't really got to tell anybody about it. So this is the thing. It's like people are discovering it, being all, who the hell's behind all this? And, you know, how is it developing? And, yeah, we haven't even got to the part of, like, going to radio with it or, like, PRing it. It's just kind of blowing up. So, yeah, it's
wow. It's, I mean, there's just so much in there from... Yeah. Going out there through pure pain, you know, let's call it what it is, pure pain and grief and loss, refinding through the wise words of your wife, always listen to your wife, you know, just going in, I won't say in search, it wasn't like a quest, but, you know, just the needing potentially to get back into the sea to just to get a movement going on where you were with grief. And in that process, while you're bobbing around in minus six and howling wind and rain, you begin to notice again, gosh, this is an incredible sport and it's not being supported. And you've now come this incredible circle and using your skills through this pandemic of visual and camera. That's pretty amazing.
Oh, it's kind of, it's a lot of time. But it's kind of one of those things for me. It feels like it's replaced the releasing music thing side of me, because I can release content with all these surfers and it's helping them, and they're gaining a lot from it. As I say, they're getting all these sponsorships and it's kind of helping, you know, create this career path for them and stuff. So, yeah, like financially, it means nothing to me. But the reward on a personal level is huge. It's huge. So, yeah, by the time it goes to cinema, it'll be seen as like a work of art.
Well, it sounds like a work of art. I mean, I'm just sitting here smiling and nodding and little tingles going up and down my body going, oh my God, that's just so beautiful, because it was such a, you know, and to want to give back, because it, you know, it's just a very beautiful circle. And I imagine it will be stunning knowing your work, and even, you know, visual was certainly has been standing in the wings for a while, hasn't it, with Borders, with that has been there. So I guess it's, I can be grateful to the pandemic in one sense that it gave you that space to allow that in, but also within yourself that you are able to allow stuff like that in and let it move through you and capture it. And I mean that literally and metaphorically. And do you see yourself, like, you don't know right now, but do you see yourself moving more in that area? I don't just mean surfing, but with this kind of
As I say, like, cinema. I always, the cinema world has always been like my drive for music. I've always wanted to be, but I didn't want to be like the film guy. I wanted to be the musician that had this huge cinematic element that was like, if someone was, like, say we were at an Electric Picnic, Massive Attack comes on, they do their show, and the visual element in their show is just jaw-droppingly beautiful. Mm-hmm. They touch on so many hard topics. And it's, for me, it's seeing people like that and trying to get to that level where you can go, you know, I don't need that major label. I can be an independent Irish act and sit on that level and do something that's made home You know, I have total creative control of it. I understand it all. I can talk it. I can produce it. And it's just trying to, you know, get to that point where young artists are going to look up and be all, holy crap, learning the guitar is only the first step. We have to, like, push beyond these boundaries. And I suppose I've always had, like, you know, I was always into, like, Bjork and Tom York and people like that. And they're the people I looked up to that were always pushing the boundaries, or, you know, more recently, like, you know, Max Cooper and people like that with the visual elements, although they're not self-contained, they work a lot with other artists. There is a lot of that, you know, trying to do something that would encourage new people coming along. They want to up their game. Like Roisin Murphy is a great example. You know, we all look to her and think, wow, like, as a performer, for me, I don't really think that you could get at a higher level than where she's at right now. For image wise, for performance wise, she's just there. She's just there. She's at the pinnacle of what I think can be achieved. So it's just trying to, you know, have that mindset that you want to leave that lasting impression that will boost the island of Ireland's kind of, you know, performance sector. But that's the goal.
That's the goal. I think you will. I've always thought you will. And Lyndon certainly, for sure, knew you would.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
If we look back at young Ryan at school, or young Ryan as a teenager, or where did music come in for you?
It was kind of weird. So my father would have been a big guitar player. Mm-hmm. So he would have been on a lot of, like, the bigger Irish rock acts. When he was younger, had a pile of vinyl releases. I kind of struggled. Our childhood wasn't that pleasant because, you know, it was up and down financially. We lived in a rough enough estate. To the point where I actually, like, potentially could have died at quite a young age. I left at a machine gun that was ditched by the IRA that was in a bush beside our house when I was like 17. So yeah, so I didn't grow up in, like, a nice area or nothing. The people in it were beautiful, but it was very run down and deprived. So I think growing up with music, not being able to support the family well enough, but something seeing my father pursue quite a bit, it maybe put me off music at an early age, you know, and I was probably looking elsewhere. When I was about 13, I was playing guitar and I was playing bass. And it was kind of weird. I was always in music shops because my dad would have fixed and repaired guitars. So, you know, I would have been like the 12-year-old that stunk of fags, because back then everyone smoked in like music shops. It was really old school and rock and roll, and like it is now. But like, you know, I'd be sitting with a packet of Haribo, and they would all be testing amps all day, and you know. And so I just had this real, I was always around music and musicians. And one Christmas, it broke my dad's heart when I asked for a set of turntables. I couldn't believe it. So at the time, I had discovered rap and hip hop. And I think it was, I don't know if it's Low End Theory by Tribe Called Quest or it was the Beastie Boys, but it was along that really nice hip hop era where it was quite pleasant. It was quite jazz influenced, and it wasn't all this kind of bitches and hoes and the N-word being used a lot, because I really didn't like connect with that side of it. So it was just generally good lyrics, good beats. And I was just really intrigued. I was like, how are they scratching and how are they doing all this mixing? So my dad eventually got me these like belt driven decks. And I think for me, although I'd played guitar up to that point and in a few bands, I think when I got the decks, that's when I knew music was like a big part of my life. So I would have kind of grown up going through all the old Sugar Hill records, listening to like Gangster, people like that, you know. And I think a real turning point record-wise for me, kind of when I was around 17, was when Guru released Jazzmatazz.
Okay.
That album with like MC Sonar. And for me, it was like musically just on par with what I was really into at the time. I just really liked jazz. You know, I think there was like the Saint-Germain, the Tourist album was out as well. And I just felt like that era of music was really strong musically. They weren't really like stripped back. It was like real musicians really giving it their all, and everyone was on this like equal level. So for me at that point, I knew I wanted to do music, but I didn't want to study it in college. I kind of seen music as my paintbrush. And I seen it as my medium on which I would make art. So I was never interested in making like a structured pop song or anything that was kind of the norm. I always was challenging what I thought the norm was, and the hope to find something different. So I studied art. I done GNVQs, HNDs, went to university doing fine art. I was painting, I was doing photography. Really, really surrounded by like amazing artists, and just, it was really influential. It was hugely influential to the point where when I was in uni in Manchester, I got a grant to pay for my rent, and I went and bought a sampler instead. Much to my mom's disapproval. But that sampler like was the start of me producing. And it just kind of, yeah, it just became this thing. And it's really weird, because I was buying all these hardware and samplers and drum machines. And the reason why I was buying those was because DJing got too expensive.
Okay.
So I used to DJ on vinyl and have this huge vinyl collection, and I just loved it. I just loved going on the record shops. But what happened at that point of uni was CDJs came in. And like one CDJ was two times the price of one vinyl turntable. And then the mixers got really expensive. And I was going, well, all of a sudden I was turning up the DJ in all these clubs in Manchester, like Sankey Soaps and Scoo Bar. And I think at the time I was maybe DJing like breaks and drum and bass. It was just, again, it was in a real nice kind of era. It's kind of called full swing now, but not as pleasant, I think. But like, I just found vinyl became an issue, and became like this pain in the arse when you turned up with the vinyl. It was like, you're not here to CDs now. And it kind of put me off a little bit. So I just kind of stopped DJing and started learning production skills. So yeah, it just went under this like, years of buying gear. And then when I finally got the confidence, it was a festival up in Derry called Keltronic.
Oh yeah.
They done this like kind of call out for new artists, and the guy was called Sturdy, and he recognized me and had me booked DJing for years and stuff. And he was like, what are you doing with yourself? And I was like, I just stopped DJing and I'm just making music, and I don't really know if it's any good, or I don't even know how to record. I'm just making music. And he says, well, I do this thing where it goes live on radio with Steve McCauley from the BBC. And we just try and find new artists and give them a chance. Do you want to do it? So I turned up and everybody was like, you don't have a laptop. Where's your laptop? And I was like, oh, I don't use a laptop. Why? And they were like, well, do you not have like Ableton or how are you making music? And I had turned up with all this like early 90s kind of like drum machines. And like at this point, I hadn't really spoke to people about like production. I didn't really have a friend circle that was like in this. And a lot of the people that I was standing beside were like my peers, like the Japanese pop stars who had all these major record deals. And, you know, they were on the charts with like Lisa Hannigan and stuff. And they were just all like, we're not going anywhere. We're sitting around to wait for you because to play, because we just don't know what's going to happen right now. We've never seen a setup like this. So yeah, I played and everybody was just like, what is going on? Because it seems normal now because we have like New Jackson and all is running around and they're all doing these hardware sets. But back then everything was computers. And for me, I was never interested because the computers were so expensive to start with. So I was like, I never had that kind of money. It was like, I've had money. It was like £200 or £300 and all this kind of equipment was cheap then. Where now it's like £2 or £3 a bit. So, but like, yeah, it was just like, it was just so rare back then. And then I quickly got a name because everyone was going like, this guy's like something from the 90s. He's like running around like, well, it's hardware and he sounds like people with laptops, but like visually it's actually really exciting to watch because you could see how it's been made. And I think at that point of electronic music too, everybody was guilty of dumbing it down too much. Mm. They weren't really thinking about how they were presenting it. You know, if they're sitting in a bar surrounded by people, you know, pressing a couple of keys on a laptop wasn't really that engaging. Where I was like playing these pianos, looping them, and then, you know, punching on the drums, and, you know, and it was just this real tactile approach that I didn't realize was going to be quite a big deal for me. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I didn't really have tracks even at that point. It was just something over time, you know, festivals like yourself, Body and Soul, and like Keltronic, you know, sticking by me in AVA and just kind of putting me around all these like influential people. To the point where, you know, London had me sitting in offices in Germany and all these huge techno producers started asking me to like make noises for them essentially. So that's like another part of my career that's is quite funny because obviously when you're co-producing and ghost producing, you're on a lot of NDAs and can't really talk about it.
Okay.
And London always said, you know, it'd be funny in 25 years when you can go, who's this Irish guy that's responsible for quite a lot of techno hits that nobody knows? So he always said, I should put out a book 25 years later.
Absolutely. Let's book in
the color of techno.
Let's book in the podcast date for 25 yeah. years. Yeah, reveal all.
Yeah. It's funny because for me, it was just like a job. You know, I would go on and... there was a real problem in the techno and dance scene that I helped resolve, and it was the fact that DJs were just expected to be producers.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a lot of them had built these huge careers over being great record selectors and reading the crowd and creating this environment of bliss, essentially, on the mm-hmm. dance floor. And their careers all came to this point of, well, what does your single sound like? And they were like, well, I've never even played an instrument or... and unfortunately, the pressure over time turned the industry into this weird place of, you know, the ghost producer starting to be developed and, you know, co-producing and selling tracks to big artists. I'm probably as guilty as anyone for having a lot of involvement in that. But for me, it was obviously, it was a good financial thing to be doing.
That's a great... piece of, I have this vision of you as a little guy in with all the kind of the dudes in the shop, you know, and your dad strings and a guitar to then, yeah, rocking up with all your little drum sections. And it's a great, I'm making this sort of hand movement of like an arc. It's a great story in a sense of it also sounds like kind of pulling things apart a little bit. Like I remember saying to Pat Neary, who, as you know, booked with me with Body and Soul at Electric Picnic, going, if one more guy turns up or a girl with just a laptop on stage, yeah, like, Jesus, yeah, Christ, that's not a show. Like, I could sit there. There could be, you know, gaming. Like, we can't do this. But also, it's almost like you took everything out of the computer and put it on display for people. You're taking all of the, you know, the drum, yeah, the this. So that's, I think it's, to me, it sounds like there's a curiosity in you to get in and pull it out, to let's have a look. Yeah. And it's funny also when I hear things like, you know, I couldn't afford, so I did this. Often that just turns out to be the most exciting thing. You know, yeah, even early days of Body and Soul, when, you know, when, yeah, we had a very strong kind of booking, I wouldn't say ethos, but kind of. But a lot of that was because we couldn't afford the super big bands. So you had to cut your cloth differently. So you did go looking, you did go searching in the down the back of the forest and under the stones. And, you know, you I think you get more creative if you just don't throw money at it, you know. And it's I see that still within you, or I've heard that within you with everything you're doing now, that moving forward, the equipment that you have. Do you think, you touched on it briefly, but do you think watching your dad struggle so much financially and as a family financially, that kind of stuck in you to go, you know what, I can't do that. If we do music, then I have to have a business acumen.
I think it was that kind of, you know, baptism of fire, of just seeing it from a young age. And then there was also, when I kind of came on the scene as well, there's quite a big thing changed, like, across the music industry, and the record deals started disappearing. And a lot of my friends were dropped from major deals. And when I came on the scene, a lot of them were in their 30s, dropped from a major deal, moving back home and living with their parents, like, with no other skill that they developed over this 10-year period of, you know, being big artists. And that really scared me a lot. I was like, I can't do that to my family, for one, but I just need to learn from their mistakes, essentially. And it's, it's just being, I think it's like everything, having the awareness of it, of how things work, is really important, because a lot of people, they say stuff like, oh, that's just because they know them, or they're part of that clique, and, you know, that's why that happens. And for me, that's like a sign off of not understanding how something is working. You know, it's like, that's what you say when you have no clue about what's actually happening. And the music industry has a lot of that, where people write stuff off rather than figure it out. And for me, I think, you know, the business side of it was just trying to learn how everything works, and being an artist that understood royalties, understood, you know, sync deals, licensing, you know, management percentages, you know, booking agent percentages, like, not having to look to London for every single answer was why I think I was able to develop, where some artists can, you know, It's that whole thing where you look to others and you say, oh, they've got a great team, so I'll get that same team, but why isn't it working for me? And it's, you know, it's
the artist. You have to be part of the team as well. You have to be an active.
And a lot of them sign off. So they do, they sign off, they get the management, and then they just stop doing what they're doing. And you're like, no, it's kind of, you know, almost have to work twice as hard now.
I think I could definitely fall into that sometimes. It's like, oh no, I've got, you know, so I'll just leave you doing all of that. You know, I would definitely hand stuff over far too easily. So it's a reminder to, you have to be an active team member yourself. The team includes you, and therefore, you know, you have to, and also make sure that everyone else is doing their job, so to speak, and to know that they're doing their job, you have to understand the jobs.
Yeah, Totally.
You know, that's, I think that's a good skill set. Even, you know, looking back at some of the work I've done, I kind of always did everything. So then you knew what it entailed and you knew when somebody was bullshitting or was very good. because you knew what it entailed. I didn't do it all very well, of course, but just to have an idea of what needs to be done. So it's a real, you know, I think through it all, though, Ryan, it's a really strong growth mindset within you, isn't it? An inner strength and a growth mindset.
Yeah. I think just out of everything for me, it was just, you know, when you kind of get that level of like winning awards and being allowed into the studio with other producers and stuff, you have that many young people too watching you and asking you for advice constantly. It's like, you kind of don't want to be that person that like lets them down with this huge, like awful picture of the industry, because it's not a bad industry. It's amazing and it's very rewarding once it works for you. But it's just getting to the point where it works for you and finding that balance. There's something really beautiful about being honest with a lot of the young ones too, when they come with questions. You know, it's like, oh, I've got the single and it's on radio now and, you know, I'm thinking of leaving my job. And it's like, no, you do not leave your job. For a long time, my wife, when she played with me on stage, we would have worked Monday to Friday, jumped in a plane, flew out to Austria, played a show, got back Sunday night, straight back into work. And that was just our life until our music sustained, you know, our home. And there's this kind of like thing. It's almost like people just think it all happens quite fast. I don't know. Maybe it's to do with a lot of the TV series that are out, like X Factor, you know, everything's very turbocharged rather than like the long game.
I think you've hit on a very good point. This concept of, yeah, I've got the band name, I've got the logo, I've got the website, I've got the single out. Woohoo! You know, that's like, oh my God, love you. Woohoo! It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. You know, and I'm only looking at it from the other side of the table, watching bands come up and come through. It takes a long time. Yeah. And I can see it from some artists. It takes a long time for them to really find their sound, to really find to fine tune, to get to that place of, no, this really is the artistry that I'm going to move forward with.
Yeah, I think there's someone who said, I think I was playing with Neil Strahm one year, and it was before, it was when Spaces came out, his album Spaces, and he broke internationally. And he said to me, he was like, you know what, like, out of everything, that one of the things that I learned was, it takes 10 years for every artist to really make an impact, 10 years of hard graft. And I always remember him saying that. He's like, you know, it was only 2 years ago I was playing to 20 people in London, like literally 20 people, and I'm still playing a lot of the same tracks that I was playing back then. I think just in this game, longevity really is everything. And, you know, if he had earmarked 10 years as a real crucial point of any artist's career, then I think it's a good kind of goal to aim towards, you know, to really have things in place for that 10-year.
Wise words, Ryan. What a gorgeous conversation. I think I could just sit here with you all day, and that's neither fair nor realistic. So I will at some point have to let you go. And you know what's kind of interesting and beautiful, that we have met over the years. We shared a deep love for Lyndon. I've obviously loved your music, but we've never sat down like this. We've never, you know, I didn't know about, you know, your dad, and there's so much more I'm sure I'd love to hear about, but I've really enjoyed that. And I just wanted to say that it's really nice to have this kind of, you know, not in a bar or not shouting over this or not, you know, not about to do a gig, or, you know, it's a very different space. And you have so much to offer young musicians, and not even just musicians, young artists. That's what I suppose I hear most clearly through what you've done. It's not, music is just one of the mediums, as you said very beautifully, that was your paintbrush, but it can be applied to, I would say, a lot, you know, any medium, really. It's that ability to stay moving and open and honest. And I think I hope you commend yourself for that. I have three very simple questions that I've been asking as part of the series. They're not difficult at all. But is there anything you're sorry you didn't start earlier?
I kind of feel like everybody needs to make mistakes. Mistakes are such an important thing. So, yes, I look back and think, oh, I wish I had done that differently. But if I hadn't made that mistake, I wouldn't be where I am now.
Okay. Yeah. Is there anything you're sorry you didn't give up earlier?
Strangely, my full-time job. I probably could have left it maybe a year or two prior to what I did. It would have been financially viable, but I think I was just a bit nervous at the time.
Okay. And yeah. What are you most proud of to date? I mean, we've spoken about so much, so you've possibly, and there's so many things to be proud of, but there might be something else that you want to...
Being able to support a family for so long in Ireland, I think that's a real big one. I think any kind of young artists or anything that like come to see me, they see me living in a house that's been paid for by music. You know, they see the studio that's been built via my music. Mm. And I think that, you know, family are well looked after. It's encouraging for these younger acts to see, and I can see it having an effect on them. So, yeah, I think it's just, you know, presenting that really good image that you can do this. Mm. You know, you can be in Ireland, you don't have to be on a major record label, and you can survive and live a normal lifestyle.
Yeah, that is something to be very proud of. It really is, and very commendable. And as you say, to present that to others as, listen, this is a tangible thing. It's not, you know, and you're not living. Yeah. Also, this kind of idea of, yeah, like you have to be in LA and living in these, you know, all of this very fantasy life. But in fact, you're living a very rich life in Ireland, making incredible work. Yeah, you know. It is amazing. And tell me, when is this surf piece coming to the cinema?
So, yeah, it should be debuting in Bundoran Cinema. It's earmarked for the last week of November. Some of the edits done. So I would say it'll be December time. But people can follow it on Instagram, Facebook and all those places.
And what is the handle for that? We'll put it in the socials, but just to have it.
Yeah, so it's Tides Surf Magazine.
Okay.
Just T-I-D-E-S.
I've always found, and without trying to sound hippie, but just in general, I've always found just the power of conversation without trying to, like, I also got really, which is why I sort of landed on this concept. I hate this idea of like 10 ways to success, or, you know, this idea of success or self-help, or it's very buzzwordy and it's not very real. Yeah. And just people's stories and where you are and or a pivotal moment or like that can be very, very powerful because it's very tangible and it allows people to ruminate and talk and think. So, you know, I ain't trying to save the world, but certainly the audio space of voice and conversation, I think, can be very powerful in a very simple way.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know, and just real conversations with people. That's the only space I can go into is just, keep it real. The whole way along, I was thinking, what would Lyndon be saying? What would he be telling me to do? Because I know he'd have spin-offs and he'd have a whole host of things, whereas my brain just doesn't.
Well, we were always saying, like, the whole time of the pandemic, we just felt like the industry was flapping its wings. And we were just like, if London was here, he would be, like, totally throwing ideas left, right and center.
Oh, my God. Like, <It's> like I thought of him so much because he would just have, you know, he had this clarity is very, it's quite unusual, actually. You don't meet many like him, do you? Thank you so much. I really appreciate your support and always being able to come forward and just have really honest, open conversations is beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And come find me over in Hindsight Conversations on Twitter and Instagram.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details. Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.